Hi, everyone. My name is David Sprinzak. I'll be talking today about some new work we have on the inner ear. I would say that in general, my lab, we're very much interested in understanding how precise patterns of differentiation emerge during development. And, you know, we've seen this beautiful example of the Biomatidia yesterday from Rich's talk. And, you know, two of the key aspects that take place in these processes is the ability of cells to coordinate the differentiation and the control of cell shape and tissue morphology through cell mechanics. It's often unclear, however, how these two things are coordinated to generate these kinds of precise patterns. In my lab, we're particularly interested in processes that involve coordination between neighboring cells, and we've done a lot of work on notch signaling and notch signaling. And actually, following Michel's comment about notch, so it's actually, in our field, it's kind of common to say that there are two types of people: those who work on notch and those who do not know that yet that they work on notch. Anyway, so that's one topic that we work on planar cell polarity, which again I will not talk about, and I will talk today about this unpublished work on the inner ear. And actually, we just uploaded the manuscript to bioRxiv. Ah, and most importantly, the people that have done this work. Okay, I'll mention it at the end, but basically, this was done by Roy, who is right here, Roy Cohen. He's a PhD in the lab, and Liat is a former lab manager who's done a lot of the inner ear dissections and stuff. So let's start by looking at the inner ear. So, like many good things, right, the ear is made out of three sections. Okay, the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear. And the inner ear basically has this structure which is called the cochlea, which is basically the hearing organ. It also has the vestibule, which is related to balance sensing. And if you look at the cochlea, it's basically kind of a spiral tube. Okay, that if you look at the cross section, it has certain cavities. Over here, there's a layer of cell, epithelial layer of cell, that is called the organ of Corti. Right, and the organ of Corti is basically the hearing organ in our body. Okay, and if you zoom in onto the organ of Corti, you basically see that it has a very prototypical structure composed of these exactly four rows of hair cells. Okay, these hair cells are the cells that respond to sound vibrations and convert it into electrical signals. Okay, there are three rows that are called outer hair cells and one row that is called inner hair cells. There are different types of non-sensory supporting cells around them, and in fact they're kind of interspersed between the inner and outer hair cells. Okay, so there's these Dieter cells, pillar cells. Okay, you don't have to remember all these things, but basically you have this kind of checkerboard-like pattern of hair cells. What's quite remarkable about the organ of Corti is the amazing degree of organization in the organ of Corti. Right, so this is a picture of the mouse organ of Corti, which is very similar to ours, by the way. And what you can see is that you get these exactly positioned or organized pattern of hair cell, and this is actually persists over 5,000 cells, right? So along the cochlea, like this. Okay, and the pattern is almost perfect. There's sometimes defects, but basically this is kind of persisting, right? And the question that we ask is, how do you get this level of precision of patterns despite the fact that we often start with a disordered tissue. Okay, so this is basically the question. How do you end up with something like this? And what it's a little bit hard to see in this picture, it's basically a checkerboard-like pattern, because you have a hair cell, supporting cell, hair cell, supporting cell, hair cell, supporting cell. And that continues like this throughout the... Yes?
What is the labeling that we're seeing here?
Yes, so the blue is the actin. So you can see the stereocilia. And the red, I think it's the microtubule. And you can see the kinocilium, which is the single center, the central hair in the middle. Okay, and there's some microtubule structures there. Yeah?
As you said, I think this gets wrapped up in the cochlea. Is the spacing the same? Do the cells get smaller as they get squeezed?
Good question. So I didn't mention, right, that this is really important for, the function of hearing. Right, so it's basically this kind of an array of cells, right, is important to distinguish between different frequencies, right? And what we know is that there are different areas or different positions along the cochlea corresponds to different frequencies, and it's actually not exactly known how this frequency is encoded in different regions, but there are some differences in hair cell sizes and the stereocilia sizes. I think it's shorter and broader in the base and longer and narrower in the apex. Okay, and there's also differences in the mechanical properties of the basal membrane on which they sit. Okay, so it's not exactly known, but there are some differences. Okay.
Acoustically, isn't it sort of the thickness of the canal that would...
No, I don't think it's the thickness of the canal. Okay. I think... The what?
Acoustics is in the water, but then what
I didn't hear what you said, Boris. Okay. I don't think it's not like the waveguide, right, that the thickness of the canal is defining the frequency. I think it's more complicated than that. Okay? And I don't think it's exactly known how this frequency is encoded.
But the lattice constant is changing along the canal as well as the shape?
Very little. Okay. So, so this is the question. So, just a little bit of introduction on the development of the inner ear. So, basically it starts in mice. Okay, it starts around embryonic day 10, where you get this structure which is called the otocyst, which is close to the hind brain. And over the span of a few days, right, you get this elaborate structure develops, right? So you can see how this cochlea kind of extends during this process. Okay? And if you look at the a cross section of the cochlea, okay, different stages. Basically, you start with kind of an epithelial tube. Okay, it's a tube that it's almost a single layer, or actually a single layer. And there's a certain section in that tube that is going to be the sensory epithelium. Okay, so it's marked by some markers, SOX2 and JAGED1. And then there's some patterning along the medial lateral side, and within this patterning is mediated by a BMP gradient, and within this patterning there's a region that is going to become the structure of hair cells and supporting cells. Okay, and one more thing that I'll say is that region here, at relatively early stage, around E13.5, it gets into a post-mitotic state, right? So the cells do not divide from that point on. Okay? All right.
Okay.
Yeah?
I'm wondering if we know the mechanism of curling. Is it related to the cross-sectional symmetry?
I'll say something about that later on. Okay? I don't think it's known. But I think... Okay, I'll say something about this. All right. So now we want to look at the pattern of hair cells and supporting cells, right? In the organ of Corti. So if you look at that, and that's a image looking from the top, right, at the apical surface, you can see that within a few days, you start from a disordered, undifferentiated epithelium. And over the span of a few days, you start getting the differentiation into hair cells and supporting cells, and the arrangement into this remarkably organized pattern, right? And again, the question is kind of what drives this kind of transition? Yeah?
Here the hair cells are the ones that are nicely circular, and the supporting ones are
like... Yeah, they're like the hourglass shape, right? Okay. So they have this really thin morphology here, but as you can see, this is also something that evolves during development. By the way, what you see here, the labeling is, you have Z01 that marks the tight junctions, right? And ATO1 is basically a master regulator for hair cells, okay? Which is kind of is shared with the omatidia in a sense, right? So the master regulator for the sensory organ, or sensory cell. All right. The classical... Okay, so the question is, how do you get this perfect organization? Basically, you can, you know, divide the process into two types of processes. One, differentiation circuits that control the hair cells and supporting cell, and that would involves signaling and regulatory circuits and notch signaling and so on, right? And cellular reorganization processes that control the shape and position of the cells. Now we already know that. The whole shape of the organ of Corti changes, right? It elongates and actually performs this convergent extension. Okay, so there are dramatic changes. Okay, but again, I remind you, in the organ of Corti, there are no cell divisions, right? Whatever cells that we start with, these are the cells that have to suffice for the final pattern, right? So how do we make sure that we have the right number of cells in the right organization, okay, without any cell divisions? Now, Boris.
Can you just go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
So, relate the question. So just puzzle, there are these in the hair cells and outer hair cells.
Yes.
And in other pictures, it sort of looks like they're actually part of the same lattice.
Ah, no.
But so here they kind of look incommensurate, right? These outer hair cells at this stage are larger, and presumably there are fewer of them if we start counting them over.
I'll show that in a minute, right? But there are actually two different developmental processes, right, that they're separated in time. The inner hair cells are the first to appear, right, and the outer hair cells come later. And there's actually a special layer that is called pillar cells that separates between them, okay?
But ultimately, they're commensurate or incommensurate?
No, they're incommensurate. Yeah.
Apoptosis?
No apoptosis.
Okay, so really the cells are the cells.
Yeah. The cells are the cells. Okay. Yeah.
How about the lateral and basal geometry?
Yes. Yeah. Very particular basal geometry. I will talk about it later on. But for now, I'm going to focus on the two-dimensional layer, okay? It's actually turns out to be important, okay, for the way we think things are organized, all right? So the classical model for generating a checkerboard-like pattern is called lateral inhibition. Boris introduced that in the first day, right? And the idea with lateral inhibition is basically that at some point during development, all the cells would like to become hair cells, and at the same time try to inhibit their neighbors from becoming hair cells. Right, so there's a local competition between the cells. So this is mediated by this intercellular feedback loop that is mediated by notch signaling. This is where I come from, okay, thinking about this process. We've been modeling this process in various aspects, and there are other people here that are looking at that. So it's a very classical model, and indeed if you take a field of cells, right, and you apply this model, you will get a kind of checkerboard-like lattice. Okay, so you can get a checkerboard-like lattice. The problem is that there are a few problems. Okay, the first problem is that typically these lateral inhibition processes are very sensitive to noise. They are not a very good way to generate a very large repetitive structure, okay? Because you can see that even here in the simulation, you have these defects, right? And the reason is, right, this is a competition between cells, right? So the initial conditions actually would affect, you know, who would become hair cell and who would become a supporting cell. So you can start generating a lattice in one place, right? But then in another place in the lattice, you would start generating a different incommensurate lattice, so you would get these kind of defects and so on, right? So it's not a good way to generate even an organized pattern, even if you start with a perfectly hexagonal lattice, okay? Now, moreover, right, if you look at the outer hair cells, for example, right, there's a different symmetry. Right? Here, for every hair cell, you have like two or three supporting cells. It's a hexagonal symmetry. This is a square lattice, basically. So you have one hair cell, one supporting cell, one hair cell, one supporting cell. Right? So again, we have a problem that these types of lateral inhibition, right, are not sufficient to explain how you get this kind of pattern.
But if you took this model and you started in square lattice initially, yeah, did you not get something that was closer to?
You could, but you would still get defects. Okay, you would still get defects.
You get a one-to-one ratio.
Right. But the thing is that we usually don't start with square lattice. We start with a disordered lattice, right? And if you apply them all on a disordered lattice, you just get a disordered salt and pepper, right? So this is what you expect to get. So by itself, this kind of lateral inhibition is insufficient, right? Yeah.
So these kind of models typically assume some sort of ultra-sensitivity. Right, in the notch signaling, so that it ends up being bistable. If you were
bistability, exactly. It's multi-stability, yeah.
So is there actually any empirical support for ultrasensitivity in these networks, or?
Yeah, so actually, you know, there are known examples for lateral inhibition. In fact, also in the inner ear, the selection of hair cells and supporting cells is based on lateral inhibition, or is believed to be based on lateral inhibition, and there's been a lot of work on showing that indeed this is the case, that you get this kind of bistability in many of these lateral inhibition systems. For example, if you look at bristle patterning in Drosophila and Francis Coisson here has done some work on that with Francois Schweifgott. I worked on that. You can basically show that different ways, both experimentally and theoretically, that this model kind of applies, right? And you get this kind of bistability. Okay.
So the parameters actually are, because I can imagine you could have mutual inhibition that's just monostable, right? But then because of some sort of geometry, if you only had like one in the center.
Yeah, actually, what you find when you analyze this is that if the mutual inhibition that you see here has a higher sensitivity, Hill coefficient bigger than one or two for a two-dimensional lattice, right? You can easily get to conditions where you get this kind of pattern. Okay, so this has been mapped, and we can. This is pretty general. Okay. All right. So what we figured out is what you have to take into account, of course, is cellular mechanics, and of course in this audience, I don't have to persuade that this is a potential source for that. And and when you look at the cellular mechanics, you usually think about the shape of the cells, you know, at the 2D level, as determined by the local forces that act on each cell and each boundary, right? And you basically locally get to at each time point you get to a local equilibrium, which sets the position and size and morphology of the cells. And I know that the Madhav gave an introduction yesterday to the vertex model, right? So we haven't had a talk yet that talked about that. I'll talk a little bit more later on. But this is the type of models that have been used or actually developed by people here in the audience. All right. So, of course, the biological systems, developing systems, are not in equilibrium, right? So they invest energy to change their shape and morphology, and the way this is done, we talked quite a bit about that, are through intercalations or through morphological transitions like intercalations. And I'll also mention delamination, which is basically that a cell loses its apical footprint and the other cells take over. Okay?
So that's the moral equivalent of apoptosis.
It's the equivalent of apoptosis. Okay? But we don't, there are markers for apoptosis, we don't see them in the system.
Oh, we've got.
Okay.
They pop out into the third dimension and then are lost, or what happens?
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
So, and basically the way we can now frame the question is, how do the combination of regulatory circuits like lateral inhibition, right, and cellular reorganization drive the transition from a disordered undifferentiated pattern, right, to this highly ordered organized pattern, right? So this is what we're trying to do. And so basically we look both at the experimental and the modeling side. And on the experimental side, we basically dissect the organ of Corti of mice, okay, at different time points. And we can look at that either fixed samples, or we've developed this inner ear explant assay to image the dynamics of the system. And the modeling side, we basically think about the hybrid models that combine lateral inhibition models with 2D vertex models, right? In the sense that lateral inhibition can generate two types of cells that may have two different, or may have different mechanical properties, right? So that would affect the 2D vertex model. And on the other hand, the 2D vertex model may change the connectivity between the cells, right, or the morphology of the cells, and that may affect lateral inhibition. I will mostly talk about this direction, starting from lateral inhibition to the 2D vertex model. All right, so the first thing we wanted to do is to try to understand more quantitatively the transition into an organized pattern. And so we started by looking at the fixed cochlea. And one interesting thing about the fixed cochlea is that there is a developmental gradient from the base to the apex. So the base is more advanced, like you see here, and the apex is less advanced, right? And as time progresses, there's a kind of a slow wave of developmental progress that advances. Now, it's different from the morphogenetic furrow that Rich talked about the other day. There's no sharp boundary that progresses. This is a very gradual and slow transition. Okay, yeah.
Is it base and apex in the sense of the organ coordinates, or on the same cell? I'm used to apico-base.
Yeah, so yeah, I'm going to talk about both. So okay. There's a apical basal, okay, and then there is base to apex, okay? So it's going to be...
Okay, these are different cells.
Yeah, so So this is very, very large, right? This is this is about a millimeter, okay? That's the size. But it contains many, many cells.
And how long does it take, roughly, until the thing is fully patterned?
Let me show you. Okay. So basically, we can get this kind of array or matrix of images, okay, looking at different time points, right? So E15.5, E16.5, and so on. Right, and look at different positions. Of course, we don't only limit ourselves to single three positions, but we can get this kind of matrix. And you can see that it starts around E14, E15 in the base, right, and ends up at around P0, right, in the or even a little bit later in the apex. Okay, so that's the time scale. And there are a few things that we can see already just by looking. Oh, yeah.
Possible developmental gradient from inner to outer. So you already told us that inner patterns first we see it,
but there are three layers of outer.
Ah, so do you see that the first layer appears first, then the second, then the third? We don't see that. Okay, yeah.
There's another great analogy. So the way you've presented this data, it might be there might really be this templating going on from base to apex, right? Which is that it seems like you get differentiation in the base and then the apex, right? In time.
Yeah.
And that sort of, there could be a front that's propagating from base to apex. Is that how I should think about it? Or these are independent and they just happen at different times?
Yeah, so what we see, right, is we see kind of a slow graded wave, that seems to progress.
Okay,
now, is there something that kind of passes from one position to the next? I don't think so, but I cannot rule it out. Okay? Basically, we think that if you look at a certain position, there will be a sequence of events that will be independent of what's going on earlier. All right? But, okay.
But of course, this is fixed tissue, right? So when we say, when I scan across the row here, these are different cochlea.
Yes, these are different cochlea. When you scan across the different columns, right? Then it's a single cochlea, I think. Okay, that's it. All right. So a few observations. One is already we mentioned is that there's the first features that you see that appears is the inner hair cell. Okay, and next to that this pillar cell layer, which has this very distinct kind of rectangular morphology. Okay, now this is important because it kind of sets the boundary conditions for whatever will come afterwards. Okay, and the other thing that we can, of course, see that we seem to start with something that looks like a disordered lateral inhibition that gradually becomes more and more organized. Right, so there's a gradual reorganization of the process. Okay, so to get some more quantitative aspect, what we do, we take these large scale images of the cochlea. This is basically a tiled 9x9 high resolution confocal images, and we can get these types of images for every part along the cochlea, and we can segment them and basically mark all the hair cells and supporting cells and get information about the shape and connectivity of the cells. Okay? And the first thing that we wanted to do is to define some sort of order parameters that tell us the level of organization in a more quantitative manner. Right? So we know that this is more organized by this, right? We look at that, but can we define certain order parameters? So we define two order parameters for this. The first one is basically looking at this middle row of hair cells, right? And each of these hair cells, we can count the number of supporting cells it has, right? And in the final pattern, we basically have four supporting cells for each hair cell, right? Just like a checkerboard board. Okay, but if you look earlier, you get more supporting cells. Right, more closer to the hexagonal-like behavior. Right, so clearly there's some processes that need to happen in order to reduce the number of supporting cells as progression occurs. Okay, so the second thing is the fact that basically if you look at the organized pattern, the more organized pattern, you see that the hair cell form around each central hair cell form these very nice hexagons, hexagonal shape, right? So what we basically do here, we fit the neighbors of each hair cell into something which we call symmetric hexagon. It's a regular hexagon that has an additional degree of freedom that can be squeezed in one axis compared to the other, okay? And in the parameter is basically the goodness of fit or the chi-square difference between this hexagon and the polygon that is formed by the centers of the hair cells. Okay, so so these are the two order parameters, and basically here's data from analysis of different time points and different positions. We look at different positions from the apex to the base. So if you, for example, if you look at E17.5, right, you can see that you start at the apex, which is less advanced. You start with higher number of supporting cell neighbors, and it becomes closer to 4, right? And again, you can look what happens at different time point. An earlier time point, you get even higher number of supporting cells, and at the P0, it's very close to 4. Okay, so it's a very gradual transition into 4 neighbors. Yeah?
In the previous slide, is the amount of green, can I sort of really take that as a quantitative readout of how far progressed I am, or is it some very nonlinear thing? I'm asking this for sort of
yeah.
What really is, what are you lighting?
Yeah, so the green marker is basically an ATO1 GFP mouse. Okay, so it reports on ATO1 activity. So in a sense, it is somewhat a measure of how much ATO1 transcription factor each one of these hair cells have. We have not done quantitative analysis on these to see how they vary. What we can see in these mice is that the, you know, just like you see this wave of patterning, right? We can see them kind of turning on, right? If we look at earlier stages. Okay. Yeah.
Can we go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
I'm just curious. So you define these order parameters that hang on the differentiated cells, but right very early on there isn't much green. But we can look just at the red, right? So just purely cell morphology.
Yeah. So.
And one thing that comes to mind is anisotropy, right? So just looking at the edges of this alpha zone, right? You kind of see the red running more or less as a straight line, right? So you can imagine defining some sort of edge anisotropy parameter.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if it could be important because. Your business of not being able to order just bilateral inhibition is a two-dimensional problem. In one-dimensional problem, you don't have much of an issue. Well, you can still have defects, but you can imagine
especially
you propagate a wave in one dimension, lateral inhibition will do fine, thank you very much, right?
We have not, we have not done this analysis. It would be interesting to see that. But earlier stages than this, right, you don't see this anisotropy. So they're not organized into rows. And it's very hard to identify rows at the first stages of
I guess that's what Boris is saying, is to sort of measure the onset of that anisotropy, right? So if you get all the orientations of all the junctions,
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, it's, we can take a look at that.
Just that anisotropy will help.
All right, but I would say already that we'll get to the we'll get also to the dynamics.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, that's the. All right, so again, if you look at the number of supporting cell neighbors, it basically goes down and converges to 4. Okay, and if you look at the goodness of fit, and the smaller chi square is a better goodness of fit, again, you get this kind of gradual organization. So basically, this tells us that whatever model that we come up with has to explain these two aspects, right? That there's a decrease in the number of supporting cell neighbors, that there's an increase in the hexagonal order of the system. Yeah.
If we look at these differentiated cells, they change the shape from a polygon to more of kind of circle,
round,
right?
Yeah.
So it suggests that the square lattice is much more preferable for these cells compared to the ones with...
Yeah, but actually we get the point where they start to be more round occurs a little bit later, okay? And also we get the reorganization processes even before we see them kind of roundish. Okay? So but there is a point about what you're saying, and we'll get to that. But as you pointed out, there is a very big there's also morphological changes of the hair cells and supporting cells. Again, this is at the apical surface. Okay, and you can see that the ratio between the hair cells and supporting cell basically increases. Okay, as you go towards the base, and I should have put the axis in the opposite direction because it's confusing. Okay, so. So basically, hair cells become bigger and supporting cells become slightly smaller, right? As time progresses. All right. So the next part was to try to look at the dynamics of reorganization processes, and for that, we developed this live inner ear explant imaging assay, okay, which is basically dissecting these inner ear cochlea, embedding it on a plate. Okay, and putting in the microscope, and this actually has taken us a couple of good years until we got it right. It's a very tricky business to do these dissections and to get them right and to do the imaging. Of course, you also need to label the boundaries, and we use this mouse, which is the Z01 GFP mouse, which marks the tight junctions. And okay, let me show you some of the images. So this is the first thing I'm going to show you is actually from an early stage, E15.5, around the mid apex. And this is a situation where it's actually kind of hard to identify where are the hair cells and supporting cells. Actually, the organ of Corti is here. There are some inner hair cells that you can identify from their round shape on this side. And these cells are called Hansen cells. Okay, and we'll talk about them in a minute. Yeah?
How do you identify the boundary of the organ of Corti? It looks somewhat arbitrary at this point.
Yeah, so you will also see how that when the movie progresses, you can identify it. But there are certain things that we notice, right? For example, there this line here that is a little bit brighter that marks the... okay, I know that it's you can train your eye, and you will see that also as time progresses. Okay, it's not always so easy to do that, but you know you will see that you can identify the inner hair cells a little bit later in the movie. Okay, so I'm going to run the movie, hopefully, and what you will notice is that there's pretty dramatic changes, right? And in particular, you will see that there's this kind of shear motion on these cells. Right. So these cells that are over here, they move faster. The cells that are over here, they move slower. So there's this pretty dramatic shear movement across these cells. These cells, the Hansen cells, if you've noticed, they actually are pretty dynamic. They move. Okay, I will show you another image of that in a second. So they kind of slide. They also divide. So these guys can divide. Right, and they can move. So you have this pretty significant shear motion on the system. Okay, and we can quantify it, right? So basically, you can look at the positions that at the beginning of this movie are at the same horizontal position, and look how they move as a function of time, and we use something which is called image registration algorithm. So even without segmenting the cells, okay, we can follow how the whole system evolves over several hours, and we can see that there's the displacement in the x direction actually increases with when you go with a higher position compared to this inner hair cell line, so you get this kind of nice correlation. Okay, but you also see that in the Y position, there's a slight compression in the system, right? So this is the DY.
So when you see the bright spots, was a cell extruded there?
Which bright spots?
Well, at least from here.
Like here?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Not necessarily, but we do see some of these transitions, like delaminations. I will come to that.
Because when if you look earlier, I don't know if it correlates to those cells there. So you can see that there's one cell and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 around. Is the one at the center the one that was extruded later?
I cannot tell from here. Okay, I cannot tell right here, but I'll show you an example. It's actually, there are some extrusions, but they're not very common. All right. Okay, I just want to show you. This is from a later stage. Okay, so the cells are already pretty packed. Okay, they're not really moving. So this is E17.5. But look out at the Hansen cells. Oh. Okay, so pretty dramatic movement. Okay, we do see them, and they continue like that until relatively later stage. Yeah.
And you think this is really not active migration? You think this is displacement?
What's the difference?
Active migration would be protrusion braids, and they migrate along extracellular matrix or along other cells, while displacement would be there's more cells coming in from one side, and they displace the cells.
I don't know how to distinguish between them.
Okay.
You could look at whether there's protrusions, like R2-3 mediated protrusion in the cells at the top, or adhesion that sort of would break the symmetry.
You mean look at the basal side, or...?
The basal side of those cells.
The problem is that the Z01 marker, right, just marks the tight junction, so we cannot see the protrusions or any other parts of the cells. We need another system to do that. Okay, we're very interested in trying to understand what's causing this. Yeah.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Which one?
Yeah, this one. So staring at the top panel there, I can imagine that there is some sort of a shear zone, so between 4 and 10, let's say. And so where would that be in the tissue? Right. So you chose to fit it with a single line. And,
yeah.
And of course, it's wonderful to have fit with fewer parameters. But in this
so you case, say maybe
I wonder
it's more here.
Okay.
So maybe the shear is faster here compared to here. H is the distance from this line.
Yeah, right?
So that would mean that you,
I don't know what the scale is. So roughly going from 4. So suppose for a moment that that's a real effect.
Okay.
Where would it be on the left panel?
So I think it would be halfway. Okay, so basically we look from this line, okay, which is the inner hair cells, all the way to that point.
So zero is that purple
this is the starting point, right?
That's the purple dashed line.
That's the dashed line.
The dashed line.
So in a sense
the... in this one, but... the dashed line is supposed to be at the pillar cells.
Okay, yeah, but the dashed line starts here, right? So we look from the dashed line. I mean, we could have put zero in this axis.
Yeah, so something with the axis is probably, I'm not sure about it.
Okay.
But
I think that basically we start from here and go up. Okay, so that's the scale.
The zero is supposed to be like the dashed line, so minus is the inner, the inner hair cells, and plus is the outer region. So zero is supposed to be the pillar cells.
Mm-hmm. So you say that maybe you're right, actually, that below the inner hair cells,
region.
We have much.
So what's the top of the layer, whatever the Hansen cell, right? So that boundary is well defined. So is it the 10, the 12, the 8?
So each cell is about like 5 microns or 4 microns in height, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's about like 10 is I think at about 10 or 12 is the limit for the Hansen cells. Mm-hmm. This is something about it.
Okay, got it.
All right. So of course we...
I probably missed that. So at this stage, convergent extension has already completed, or they're happening at the same time?
There's still convergent extension that occurs even at this stage.
Okay, so
in a sense, the convergent extension is not standard convergent extension, right? It's kind of sheer convergent extension.
I think the junctional remodeling is standard, then, but the extension part, the T1 transition part from.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
So we can see the junctions being shrunk in one axis.
Yeah.
Then the opening in the perpendicular axis is being driven by the shear, right?
Yeah.
It looks like.
Yeah, that's the way we think about it. I mean, again, this is an explant, right? So it's kind of outside of the context, but yes, this is the way we think about it. All right. So we see, of course, a lot of these intercalations throughout these reorganization processes. So here is an example for this intercalation. This is a slightly more advanced stage, E17.5. So the two cells start as being neighbors, and they end up as not being neighbors. And then the other thing that we see is that we see these delaminations. They're not very often, okay, but they're there. So follow this guy. Whoop. Okay. And it's basically supporting cells, okay, that are delaminating. So clearly, it's a way for reducing the number of supporting cells in the system. All right. The other thing that we see that I want to point out is this process that we call squeezing out. Okay, it's basically what you will notice is this cell, which is somewhere in the middle of the organ of Corti, is going to be pushed out toward the boundary cell layer. So you can see it here. Okay, so again, this kind of squeezing out is another way to reduce the number of supporting cells.
Does it become a Hansen cell?
Okay. No, or at least not that we can see. Okay, we sometimes see cells delaminate from this boundary layer, but we don't see it become a Hansen cell.
Okay. If I remember correctly, the Hansen cells are moving anti-parallel to the nearest origin of Corti cell. So the left to right motion that you showed us with the shear originally, and then I thought the Hansen cells were going in the opposite direction.
No, I mean the reason that you've seen the Hansen cell going in the other direction is it's because we have two types of ears, right? The left and right, so sometimes we get the direction converted.
That would explain.
All right. So let's look at a kind of an intermediate summary of what we learned from these images. Okay, from the morphological analysis, we see that the number of supporting cell neighbors around each hair cell is reduced, that hair cells gradually reorganize into hexagonal pattern, and that hair cells become larger. Okay. From the live explant imaging,
their apical surface becomes larger.
Yes.
Do you know whether this is true for the whole cell? Or
we don't think so. Okay, we don't think so. I'll talk about the three-dimensional structure in a minute. Okay. And from live explant imaging, we see that the organ of Corti exhibits this very strong shear motion. There are multiple intercalations and delaminations that are observed, and that supporting cells delaminate or squeeze out from the organ of Corti, which helps you reduce the number of supporting cells around each hair cell. Right? And now, the question is, how can you take all this information and try to come up with a model that explains this transition from a disordered lateral inhibition into this very highly organized pattern? And for that, we decided to develop this model that is based on the 2D vertex model. I will mention it briefly here, the idea behind it, and then I'll mention how what do we assume in our model. Okay, so basically in a 2D vertex model, these cells are defined as polygons. Okay, this is of course a simplification because you know some of our cells are really round, but it's just an easy simplification for us because it makes our life easier to describe everything in terms of the vertex model. And then there are certain mechanical properties that are associated with the mechanical energy of the system. Okay, and the mechanical properties include the bond tension, okay, which basically increases with the length of each bond. Okay, there's a certain preferable area for each cell corresponding to some internal pressure. So if you try to make the area of the cell, the apical area of the cell, bigger or smaller, you pay a certain mechanical energy. So this is this quadratic term here. Okay, and there's a term that depends that basically describes circumference rigidity that depends on the circumference of the cell. So this is correspond to the actomyosin cables on the cortex of the cell, trying to make the cell a little rounder. Okay, if you have a stronger contractility, and there might be some additional external forces working on the cells, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay. So, okay, and in principle, these kinds of models have been used to describe multiple systems, and now we wanted to come up with some assumptions based on the observations that can explain this transition based on the model. And basically, what I'm going to argue here is that there's two main assumptions that are sufficient to explain the transition into this organized pattern. The first assumption, oh, I didn't mention, this is we also introduced the intercalation and delaminations. Oh, sorry, I jumped ahead. So what are we trying to model? Okay, what are we trying to model is the following. We're basically focusing on what happens at the outer hair cell layer, and we assume already that the inner hair cell layer is a pre-pattern. Okay, so it's already there, one line of cells, okay, defining a certain boundary. This is already there, and now we say, okay, how do we get from this disordered lateral inhibition to this final organized pattern? Now we consider two processes that are not necessarily separate, but we treat them separately. The first one we call the initial compaction, is how these cells become organized into the hexagonal pattern, right? And the second stage, which we call refinement, is basically the fact that the hair cells grow and get finally rearranged. Okay? So we have to define some initial and boundary condition. And as I already mentioned, we assume there's already this special line of cells, the inner hair cells. This serves as a kind of a boundary condition for whatever happens in the system. These pillar cells, they're very, as I mentioned, they become a rectangular-like, which suggests that there's a very high pressure tension on the bonds between these cells and all the other cells. So this is what generates this straight lines. Okay, and the next thing, we say that there's a certain regime, okay, from this single layer of cells where we allow lateral inhibition to occur. Okay, so this is just applying the same lateral inhibition circuit that you've seen before over a certain range from this boundary layer. Okay, now we continue to apply this lateral inhibition in the sense that if there's now going to be some rearrangements so that a supporting cell within this range does not touch any other hair cell, it could become a hair cell. Okay, so it allows the differentiation of new hair cells.
So is this simple model capable of getting hourglass shapes for this?
No, it is not capable because the hourglass shapes are not polygons, right? So
Absolutely. So
this is limited to polygons. Yeah, Maya.
Before we get to mechanics, if I inspired by Michelle's talk of just packing, imagine I had two kinds of particles, those that swell and those that don't, and I just shear a 2D layer as I'm injecting water into the system. the guys that grow will eventually equilibrate to some sort of hexagonal packing like you're seeing.
That's a packing problem, right? Yeah,
it's
you're basically going towards what I'm going to talk about exactly. Okay, so basically the question is, how do you start with something that is organized this way, right, and end up with something that is organized in a hexagonally packed, right? But you still have to solve the problem of getting the right number of hair cells and supporting cells during this process, right? So that's the question. And as I started to mention, we basically have two main assumptions that we consider we introduce into the model. Okay, the first assumption is that we assume there's global shear on hair cells, okay, towards the pillar cells. And again, we kind of introduce this global shear by hand. Okay, this is kind of packing, and the idea is that basically each of these hair cells feels diagonal force, okay, that both compresses the cells, right, and introduces this kind of shear, right? So this is the first assumption. The second assumption is that there's some sort of a local repulsion between the cells. So two hair cells don't like to get too close to each other. Okay, and in a minute, I'll try to get to what could be the physical processes behind these forces. So the third
assumption literally works on the green cell. So it doesn't
on the
go
green
through
cells.
The underlying vertex model. So
yes.
These cells have a way of talking to each other mechanically,
yes,
other than through vertex model.
Yes, exactly. Okay, and we will talk about how this can be in the next slide.
And you'll get three layers coming out naturally, or you'll put them in?
Let me show you. Okay.
And I'm sorry, one last technical question. The Hansen cells are typically much bigger than the other cells. That's not.
I know. We're not introducing it into the model. We try to make things really, really simple. Right. Okay. The last assumption is basically saying that the hair cells are more rigid than the supporting cells, right? So the supporting cells are kind of more fluid, and the hair cells are kind of more rigid. Okay. And we have some support for that, as you will see in a minute.
How do you insert rigidity?
The what?
Which of your parameters is this rigidity?
So we do it in two ways, and we can actually play with it a little bit. One way is the incompressibility on the pressure, right? And the other way is on the contractility. Okay, so in fact, I think we set both of these parameters twice as much as in the hair cells than in the supporting cells. Okay? And the analogy is, right, or the combination of global shear and local repulsion can actually drive the system into this hexagonally packed system, okay, in a process that is analogous to crystallization. Actually, there's a very similar process which is called shear-induced crystallization. Okay, so this is basically, Madhav, what you mentioned, right? That's the main idea. Okay, so I'm just flashing the details of the model, and you can come and talk to me. So in addition to this, right, this is the local repulsion, and there's an external force that has a direction in the X, right, and that's the shear direction, and also has direction in the Y, that's the compression, right, and we minimize according to these external forces. Now, the point is that these external forces are kind of, you know, put from the top. Okay, now the question is, okay, how can you, where do they come from, right? Yeah.
So are all the gamma ij's the same?
Yeah, so initially, yes. Okay, but on the second stage, we actually change them.
And
okay,
they become different. Like different gamma ij's are different.
Different. For example, you would have different tension on different bonds. If you have bonds between two supporting cells or between a supporting cell and a hair cell.
Also, they are like three of them, right? So
that but two hair cells they usually don't touch each other. Okay, so basically you have two types.
And the repulsion coefficient is a fitting parameter?
Yes. Okay, it's
six, or
the what?
What is its value? Is it 4 or what is it?
Kappa, I think it's 6. Okay, but I don't think that it matters because we play around with it. Okay. All right. So what could be the you know physical basis for these forces? Again, this is a hypothesis. There's actually now we're looking at the three-dimensional picture of the tissue, and there's actually a very interesting observation here that actually the hair cells or the nuclei of the hair cells are in different plane compared to the nuclei of the supporting cells. Right? So there's some sort of spatial separation between the hair cells and the supporting cells. Okay, which means that if you have these Hansen cells and they apply the external force, they can apply the shear force at the nuclei level, right? And kind of generate this kind of shear. And again, also the repulsion, right? Like what Boris asked about what generates the repulsion between two cells that don't touch each other. Okay, we think that this can be explained by the fact that these nuclei are actually touching each other. Okay, so you cannot compress them further. Okay, then or at some point you cannot compress them further than a certain distance between them. Okay. So that's the idea. Okay, now the simulation. Basically, I start with this disordered lateral inhibition. Okay, and I now apply the global shear and local repulsion. And you can kind of see how the cells kind of crawl in. And you can see the supporting cells squeezing out, right? Because they're more liquid-like, right? And basically end up with something that has a pretty high hexagonal order in the system. Right, so it's not perfect, but it's actually pretty nice. Right, so just by adding the global shear and local repulsion is sufficient to drive the system into this highly organized hexagonal pattern.
The width of the shear was added by hand, and that's what determines the three layers of both.
Yes, there's a certain range here.
Yeah.
Okay, and actually, there's one more thing. Right, so how do you make sure that you have exactly the right number of cells? That's actually a problem. Okay, in the simulations we can play with it a little bit, but in the here in this simulation you have a periodic boundary condition, right? So you cannot everything goes in this direction, right? When you look at the shear, right? But when in the real system you can think that if you have extra cells, right, and you have shear, right, they're pushed over until they find a position to go in, right? So they slowly they can go inside. Right, so this kind of model captures the decrease in the number of supporting cells and the increase in the degree of hexagonal order in the system. And I want to show you the analogy, which is called shear-induced crystallization. So this is an experiment that was done by this group, Zayed et al. It's basically glass beads in a device that allows applying shear. Right, and you will see that... let me start to run it, right? And you can see that you know you get shear from the top layer, and you can see how the beads basically organize into this hexagonal array of cells.
So we know what causes the shear here. What causes the shear in your system?
Right. So what we think causes the shear in our system are the Hansen cells, right? Since they're moving, right, or migrating and dividing. They're doing this. Now, I would say another thing about the shear, right? The point that you have a shear, right, and not simple convergent extension may also explain the fact that you get this kind of, you know, spiral shape behavior, right, of the organ of Corti, right? So it's actually kind of interesting to think that this is the source for the chiral shape of the spiral. Yeah.
Have you had a chance to look at this at the molecular level? How, for example, molecular models are distributed?
Yes,
or how
coming up. Okay, yeah.
So I guess the controlling parameter in this in the glass bead experiment would be the initial volume fraction.
Yeah.
It will determine whether you get crystallization or not.
I think what they have here, they have different conditions, right? So or different ways they do that. They can either introduce some sort of pressure from the top. So there's some sort of pressure from the top, right? So there's kind of fixed pressure, right? Or you can do a fixed volume, and then just have to make sure that you have the exact, the right number of beads. Yeah.
So I guess like the equivalent parameter in the vertex model would be like what is the fraction of the hair cells, the initial fraction of the hair cells.
Right.
Would that matter for the final state of the system?
Mm. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. Would be nice to generate mutants where you can get more hair cells. And in fact, there are ways that we can do that. For example, by blocking notch signaling or partially blocking notch signaling, we'll generate more hair cells and then see how things reorganize. Yeah. Hello.
So I guess the one singular difference between your vertex model, this, and what you said is going on in the real system, is that you by hand put in the mechanical difference between green cells and not green cells,
yes,
in your vertex model at t equals zero.
Yeah.
Right at the beginning.
That's right.
Whereas in your movies, it seems that size dispersity between hair cells and support cells, as well as the green difference, is not that much initially. And I guess just a comment on that. Do you think so? If I ask you, has the shear already begun when the green pattern is sort of more homogeneous, and then you know?
Yeah.
When does the shear start? How about that question? When does the shear start?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I know the answer for that. I don't. I think it starts earlier.
Earlier than when you can see dust.
But, I don't have a good answer for that yet. Yeah. Just because, okay, and the reason is because, you know, we can do the dissections and look at the boundaries at certain ages, right? It's hard to see what happens at an early age.
So I'm going to go back to the question of anisotropy. So it's shear-induced crystallization, but the question is how good that crystal is. So there is clearly a very good layering, right? But even at this snapshot, if I look at it, I see a square lattice on the right and a hexagonal lattice on the left, right? So there's clearly a formation of lamella, which is sort of well known in the shear flows. And the crystallinity is a weaker thing, which is much less robust. And it's not, I think it's much easier to generate, if you like, symmetric order than sort of fully crystalline order.
Boris, this looks like it's in 3D, this movie, right? So it's moving in and out. If you
it
really
is in 3D.
Really sure, so if you really had 2D.
But look, I mean, this is a projection. It's not a crystal.
But actually, there's no. There are points that are in the movie that there are other situations where you get higher order of crystal order. I think it's a great question to try to see how you get this
how
level.
How robust is it, right? Is the question.
Right. How robust is it? And even in the maybe there's additional processes that help you resolve certain defects that arise from the initial ordering. Okay, I don't know.
It's not easy to resolve these things locally without the differentiation.
Well, we don't really see the differentiation.
My point exactly.
Yeah.
Is there a confining pressure in the ecosystem? Because, I mean, that would also drive the shear system towards crystallinity.
So what we see is that there is this compression, right? That the cells become more compressed.
So the effects of the strain. So, but do you see?
Yeah.
Do you infer that there is a positive pressure that may assist the shear induced?
That's basically the assumption that we make. Okay, we don't have Okay, we might have some ways to check that, but which I'll mention in a minute. But you know, it's a good question. Yeah.
But presumably, the way out is what you're showing is very strong evidence, and very good reasons to think that shearing is generating these layers.
Yeah.
But it's happening probably at the same time as lateral inhibition, right?
No, so actually it happens.
So here in your vertex model, there are green things that have their special thing, and they're all predefined independent of morphology, right? And then morphology is sorting itself out. But if these two processes are more or less concurrent, you have another mechanism going.
Right. I think what we see is that the differentiation occurs before there's rearrangements. Okay, but we cannot be sure because the only way we have for readout for the differentiation is whether the ATO1 GFP turns on, and there might be delay from the time.
We don't have the live readout.
Well, I do, right? But it might have some delay. You know, from the point where the actual differentiation or the initial differentiation started. Okay.
Do you have any conditions where the Hansen cells are absent or static?
Yeah, I would love to have it.
but your explant system, right?
Yeah.
Can you just not include them in the explant?
No, it's really tough. Okay. The dissection is pretty tough. What we might do. The what?
Depolymerize the actin. Just put the trunculin in there.
So we're trying exactly that. Okay, we're trying to perturb the actin and see if that
maybe
is doing something.
Crush them or laser.
Yeah. So we can do laser ablation. Okay. Yeah. The problem is that the laser ablation, if you're trying to do something that is really wide across a large part of the tissue, okay, the whole tissue kind of.
Yeah, but maybe just local region.
Yeah. It's something that we really want to do, right? To see if we can perturb the shear. Okay, there's a second stage. How am I doing with time? How much? 5-10 minutes?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So the second stage is the stage that we call refinement, and the hair cells increase. Of course, this model doesn't explain how the cells become more round. Right, so that requires, let's say, internal pressure or something like this. Okay, but we also wanted to look at whether we can explain this behavior. And one thing that we noticed that the bonds between two supporting cells become really small at the final pattern, right? Which suggests that there's high tension on these bonds, right? So basically, what we do here is we introduce this high tension on the supporting cells, okay, and we introduce the top boundary layer, and we get something that is already more organized, right, and similar. And again, it's not round, okay, and there are certain defects, but it at least get the behavior that the hair cells increase, right, and the supporting cell area decrease, just because the bonds between the supporting cells decrease. Okay, so that's the second stage. Now, so one thing that you want to do, of course, is to try to introduce certain perturbations to the system and see if you can predict from the model what would be the outcome for the perturbations. So the first thing that we did, one prediction that you would have is that if you now will reduce the tension on the supporting cell bonds, right, then the supporting cells should increase in size, right? So we can do that by adding blebbistatin to our cells, and blebbistatin is an inhibitor for non-muscle myosin 2, okay? It basically inhibits myosin everywhere, but we think that it has a stronger effect on the bonds between supporting cells. I didn't mention, people have shown that there's actually different isoforms of myosin 2 in supporting cells and hair cells, which could explain the differences in the tensions. Okay, so let's look at the movie. Okay, we added the blebbistatin, and you see that the tissue kind of expands, and you see how the supporting cells become much bigger, and the hair cells hardly change in their size. Okay, so that kind of explains the, and this is the analysis, how the hair cell to supporting cell area decreases when you add blebbistatin, and it doesn't change in the control. Okay, finally, another prediction of the model, right, is that the hair cells, as I said, are more rigid, and the supporting cells are more fluid, and we wanted to check that prediction. And the way we did that, we used the laser ablation. So we're basically ablating a supporting cell here. Actually, what we do, we create a kind of a rift, right, at the tissue. So when we do that, the whole tissue kind of expands a little bit. So let me show you how it looks. Okay, you can see that this cell kind of expands and all the other cells move. And if we look at the cells, and how the area of the cells change after the ablation, I'm talking about the area of the cells around that area, we can see that the hair cells, their area doesn't change. They stay the same. Okay, and the supporting cells have a pretty large change in their area. Okay, so this is suggesting that the hair cells are incompressible, right, while the supporting cells are compressible.
So does the movie start already after the cutting?
Yeah. So right when we start the cutting. Okay, it's a little hard to see. Yeah. Anyway, so
is it just the area which is unchanged, or is it also the shape up to?
Also the shape, but what we measured is the area. So the supporting cells can have pretty relatively large changes in their shape. Okay. All right. So a summary. Okay. So basically, we think that the way you can generate this kind of highly organized pattern of hair cells and supporting cells is through mechanical forces. And we think that the combination of global shear and local repulsion between hair cells can lead to this kind of shear induced crystallization of hair cells. And that's what's driving the pattern into this highly organized pattern. There's a Feynman process where an increase in the supporting cell bond tension leads to an increase in the size of the hair cells. And also, it would be interesting to check whether these shear forces may underlie this kind of spiral shape of the organ of Corti. There are many kind of open questions. Of course, what are the molecular regulators controlling the mechanical properties of the cells and boundaries? And what drives the global shear? And what happens to cells that delaminate? Where do they go? We don't know. We actually can't really see that. We're interested to look at notch signaling and how notch signaling not only determines whether you have hair cells and supporting cells, it may also have an effect on the mechanical properties of the cells, and finally how the system reorganizes in response to perturbations. For example, if you now introduce, this is a little bit what you suggested, right? If you now introduce certain mechanical perturbation, you kill a single hair cell or a couple of hair cells, how do the pattern reorganize? And just acknowledgement for the people. So again, Roy is here. You can talk to him. Liat was also an important part of the group. Micha is a collaborator that helped us from the University of Lausanne, that helped us in the beginning of the project, and my group members and some of the funding. Thank you very much.
I'm still puzzled about volume of these hair cells, because so that would impact significantly your model, right? Whether there's conservation of volume or not, whether these guys start pumping ion, water increases, then that would change the way that you should train the model. So I was wondering if that's something that you can quantify.
In principle, yes, right? So I need to make some complete measurements of the full volume. So I need some marker that would look at the full cell. I didn't mention the 3D morphology of the cells. Okay, the hair cells are pretty kind of this kind of tear-shaped shape, right? But the supporting cells, they basically either more to the closer to the basal membrane, and they send these very long protrusions, right, that don't even fill up the distances between the hair cells, right, and just open up at the top, right? So basically the supporting cells are, you know, the volume of the supporting cells is actually irrelevant here, right? It's more about the volume of the hair cells and how they kind of bump into each other. Yeah.
So I mean, basically, as was Madhav said, right? So then the arrangement depends on the number of hair cells per volume. If you change that number, the pattern will be different.
Yeah.
Organization.
Yeah.
So that's defined prior to the start, independently.
The number of hair cells.
Yes.
Yeah. So we see a certain. That's what I'm saying. That we see a certain range. Okay, where this, the differentiation of number of hair cells that are formed. Right? And these are the ones that will end up organizing into
the input. But in your simulations, if you change the number of hair cells.
Yeah, then I could get more layers.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I had a quick question for your bluestatin data. It was very striking that the hair cells stayed the same size and the supporting cells
stayed
larger. However, their shape was also different, right? You know, where it was clear that the hair cells were. Or it looked like they were round, convex, and the others were concave. So what does that tell you?
So actually, the convex and the concave actually exist even before, right? So they have this behavior. Okay, suggests that there's some sort of internal pressure, right, that pushes them, or there's some structures on the surface, and we know there's actually cytoskeletal structure at the surface, right? So on top of the surface, there is this V-shaped stereocilia. So there's these pretty rigid elements that would define that, right? So I think this is playing an important role in setting up the shape of these cells, right? Yeah.
So one of your model assumptions was that there is some local repression between
Repulsion,
two hair cells. I'm wondering what it actually means in the physical biological sense. Is it similar to lateral inhibition, or is it in addition to lateral inhibition?
So one thing that we think, okay, I think I mentioned it, is that this repulsion is actually due to steric repulsion between the nuclei, right? So, and since this is broader here and more narrow here, right, then the distance, right, basically keeps these two elements, okay, the two apical surfaces away from each other. If you're trying to make these too close, right, they're basically sterically hindering each other.
I wonder if this business of area reduction of support cells is sort of providing kind of annealing and condensation. Just think of this as a drying suspension.
Yeah.
You have a bunch of these hair cells, and they're floating in, as in your model, in some soft fluid dynamic. And now you're taking the area out of it. And you probably don't really care about the number of cells, just about how much area is in this support fluid, right?
Right.
And then it's going to all disappear, and now you're packing two-dimensional oranges.
Right.
Right. And they will pack right into hexagonal close pack, right?
Yeah.
And then by some miracle, you just have to sort out the extra cells so there's one support per...
Right. So in a sense, I agree, okay? In the sense that the hexagonal packing, right, it kind of ignores the supporting cells.
Yeah.
Right? That's only a feature of the hair cells.
Yeah.
But I think that if the way the model I think resolves that, right, is the fact that the supporting cells have to flow, right, between, so that they allow the packing. But if you make sure that the supporting cells have a certain size, and then you kind of end up with the right number of supporting cells and hair cells, or approximately. And by the way, even in our simulation, it's often the case where it's there are defects that are not resolved, right? And maybe the
defects in the number of support cells.
Number of supporting cells. Yeah, this is something that we see in the model, and there might be some refinement processes for that. Yeah.
So that raises the third dimension, right? What's really happening here is the supporting cells are just sucking down, and the other cells are little marbles.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And then they keep sucking down, and if they're only connected to other supporting cells, they just suck right out.
That's basically the idea, right?
That's it. You don't need the shear. You don't need the flow.
Well, I think...
He says it's just drawing.
You think that it's because of the drying? No, but...
It's sucking down, yeah. So that the apex of the supporting cells is just getting smaller.
Well, but early on, it's so disordered that maybe having a shear actually helps the drying. So it has to be very, very neo, right? So.
I see. So you're saying maybe you don't even need a shear. Right, and you're saying it just reduce.
Yeah, okay, so they're stuck in their cytoplasm.
We played around with all kinds of models. So one, no, but one model that you can kind of say, right, you can kind of say it's like a differential adhesion model, right? So it's trying. And the problem with that is that with whatever we tried with the differential adhesion model. It's actually never gets organized, right?
I would say they're all highly adhered, except SC to SC. That's weaker. And then all the cells just pull their cytoplasm down. If the apex is only touching other SC cells, it just pulls all the way down.
We do see this movement, right? We do see these hair cells sliding with respect to each other.
Yeah.
Okay. So
they like to slide. Does it have anything to do with the organization?
Where would the nuclei of the supporting cells be? Because they of course also have some, right?
They're not in the picture, but they're here.
Okay, so they're very down. They're beneath the nuclei of the.
Yeah.
So all those cells is very down, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure that just by, if you just did the dehydrating model, right? Then you would still have a problem of how do you reduce the number of supporting cells, right?
Well, if they're only touching other supporting cells, they get sucked out of them.
Well, so then a model like this would suggest that there should be a lot of delaminations, right? And in fact, we don't see any delaminations. We see these squeezing out, right? So the squeezing out is suggesting that there's some sort of, they're not completely sucked out, right? They have to...
I think that would also be an interesting thing because... from the very beginning, before any of this starts, it would be interesting to ask how many cells, hair, support, and differentiated state, how many cells are there per inner hair cell, right? Because you see that, roughly. So I guess my question is, how far off the correct stoichiometry do you begin with?
For the inner? Or?
The extra SCs.
How many extra SCs? Okay, so that's actually a little bit tricky to measure, because it's a little bit tricky to early on identify which one are the supporting cells, and you also have
just counting cells, right?
So yeah.
What are local fluctuations in the number of cells, right? You know roughly what the lattice unit is, right? Because you already got the inner hair cell, right? So on average, you can calculate how many cells are there per inner hair cell.
Yeah. So we do that. We kind of do that with the number of neighbors, right? Number of supporting cell neighbors.
Okay. And, we'll do this offline.
Okay.
So, do we have more questions?